and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're hearing from Ambassador Carlos Garcia de Alba, the Consul General for Mexico in Los Angeles. He'll discuss the new NAFTA, Mexico and U.S. relations and trade in the Trump era. This event took place on July 10th at the Denina Center and was hosted by the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. President and CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, Lisa Falsko, gets us started today with the introductions.
Hello, welcome everyone. Hello, if I could have your attention, my name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's such a pleasure to have everyone here and a warm welcome from the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce Make It Monday Forum, which is co-hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. I'm so thrilled to be here and partnering with the Anchorage Chamber. Once again, you know, we do partnerships with a lot of organizations, and some get it right and some really get partnerships right. And the Chamber of Commerce is such a pleasure to work with. The things that we do together are creating something that is bigger than any of us could create separately. And we really appreciate Bruce and his staff for the professionalism and making programs like today happen. We've been here in the past year a couple of times. Hopefully some of you have enjoyed some of those programs. We started off with the ambassador from Qatar, Ambassador Al-Khawari, and that program was moderated by General Ralston. And then we brought Ambassador Kåre Aas from Norway, which I moderated, and today it is my privilege and pleasure to have Consul General Carlos Garcia de Alba, and moderated by Mead Treadwell. It's going to be a program that you're going to remember for a long time. Ambassador Carlos Garcia de Alba, he was born in the city of Guadalajara, Mexico. Impressively, he received his bachelor's degree in economics in Mexico, and then he traveled to Italy where he got a master's in political science and then a PhD in sociology. He is a career diplomat. He joined the Foreign Service in 1987 and was promoted to ambassador in 2006 to Ireland. And he was ratified by the Mexican Senate as Consul General of Mexico in Los Angeles in April 2016, where he has an impressive staff of 300 individuals there in Los Angeles. I encourage all of you to go to our website. There is a full bio that will give you a lot more information about the amazing things he's done, the locations he's been, awards, publications, initiatives he's led during his distinguished career. He's given over 300 lectures and courses on various subjects in several different languages, including coming to Alaska here. You can add that to your impressive list of all the places you've been. He speaks Spanish and French and Italian and English, and he enjoys reading, traveling, soccer, which he calls football, ping pong, movies, and writing short stories. I first met the ambassador when I was at a diplomatic dinner in Los Angeles, and we had a conversation that was unbelievable. It changed my impression. It was before the Trump administration came into office, and his refreshing thoughts and things I had never thought about NAFTA, the wall, immigration, and I was so moved by that. I wanted him to come and share all that with you, and just is my pleasure that you are making this big trip to do that and share your thoughts with all of my friends here today. Our moderator today is past president of the Alaska World Affairs Council. He's a frequent speaker of ours and moderator, and he's one of the people responsible for hiring me 10 years ago. You didn't name any of those things on your bio. We should talk about that. Prior to that, he's now the president of PT Capital. He also served as Alaska's lieutenant governor, and he was a candidate for U.S. Senate. He's recognized as one of the world's leading Arctic policy experts. I also encourage you to read his bio online. We have a more detailed bio, and I'm really looking forward to see what his next steps are going to be here to promote business, Arctic, and Alaska to the world. He's an entrepreneur, an investor. He's served on numerous boards, including the Alaska World Affairs Council, and executive leadership roles in Alaska resource development, telecommunication, and information technology companies that created innovative programs like Street View for Google, if any of you have used that. He's a graduate of Yale, where his degree was in history, but he was focused on Alaska and natural resource diplomacy, And then he received his MBA at Harvard with a master's project looking at putting the value of the Alaska Railroad, which he said the state purchased at quite a bargain. Absolutely. I'll have to talk about that later as well. Mm-hmm. And now without further delay, I'd like to hand over the microphone to Meade Treadwell.
Lisa, thank you. Lisa, you are always a gracious host, and it's a special treat for the World Affairs Council to have Ambassador Carlos Garcia de Alba with us. When I first met him just a few minutes ago, I said, you know, your last name is de Alba. That's my favorite wine region in Italy. And what did you say?
It's mine as well.
Yeah. It's where the Barolos come from, and those really great truffles.
Absolutely, the white truffles, amazing.
And then you were in Ireland, and what is Alba in Gaelic?
Scotland.
Scotland, aha. Yeah. All right, so none of us should
forget. But I'm not a Scottish, as you can see.
So you went from being ambassador to Ireland to being consul general in California, and that's actually a larger job in California than it is to be ambassador to Ireland. You've got hundreds of staffers and many, many Mexican citizens or former Mexican citizens living in the area. Do you also oversee Alaska, or how does that work in the consular situation?
Well, first of all, thank you so much to all of you for being here today, and especially to Lisa Folco, who has been so kind to invite me a few months ago to come and to speak with all of you about whatever we want to speak about, but basically U.S.-Mexico relationship. Thank you to accept to chair this conversation, Meade Treadwell and Bruce Bustamante. Thank you also for co-hosting this conversation. It was indeed a big change from being ambassador of Mexico to Ireland after 5 years to be the Consul General of Mexico in Los Angeles is a big change, but not because some friends of mine in the Foreign Service said, oh, Carlos, finally, your holidays are over. No, I was working and working hard as ambassador from Mexico in Ireland. The kind of job is different. The challenges are different. And it's true, in Ireland you have 5,000 Mexicans. Growing fast, but still, compared to the amount of Mexicans living in the US, there is no way to compare. Now, in Los Angeles, yes, I'm in charge of the largest Mexican population out of Mexico, not just in the US. It's a big population. Just the city of Los Angeles is something like 1.7 million Mexicans. Not growing, but decreasing, but still is a big amount. So the main change was the speed of the work, the variety of topics you have to deal with, but also the circumstances. It's obvious we have to speak about what changed before President Trump and after President Trump. And that has been also an important reason to be in Los Angeles. Obviously, it was not my decision, but my boss's decision to change a few people in the Foreign Service, and they thought that it was the case to send me to Los Angeles. I have been there for a year and a week. I felt that year like a few hours, indeed. It was so fast.
That's great.
But enjoying the experience and trying to do my best. I have to say, we have 50 consulates all over the US. Is the largest consular network any country has in the world, not just Mexico, any country. I'm in charge of one of those 50 consulates. 10 of those are just in California. And the one that is concurrent to Alaska is based in Seattle, Washington. Our consulate in Seattle is in charge of following Alaska. And last but not least, this is my second, well, actually my third consular position. I started my career in the Mexican consulate, not as the consul general, but just as one of the consuls in Quebec, Canada. My second consular position was Dallas, Texas, and this is my third consular position.
Oh, that's great.
diverse.
So let's get a couple of numbers on the table just real fast. How many people live in Mexico?
The population of Mexico is 125 million people. It's the 12th most populated country in the world. I think if not next year, at most in 2 years, we will overtake Japan. That is 127 million, but Japan is not growing. So very soon, Mexico will be the 11th most populated country in the world. We are not counting among those the Mexicans living abroad. Uh-huh. There are 11.7 million Mexicans living out of Mexico, by far the US being the main destiny, second Canada, third Spain, and then many more countries.
So how many people here have been to Mexico?
Good. Wow.
Okay.
It's easier to ask who has not.
Yeah, who has not been to Mexico?
Not yet.
Well, I've never not had a good time in your country. Sir, thank you. In terms of Alaska's trade with Mexico, I understand from the census statistics that we sold last year about $36 million in goods and services and imported about $28 million directly. So at least this is one of the few states that has a surplus in trade with Mexico. But between us last year, I guess there was about a $64 billion difference in imports versus exports. We're going to talk about trade in a minute, but let's get that other big elephant in the room off the table. What about this wall? It has not been a big campaign issue here in Alaska during the presidential race. I know it's gotten a lot of attention. What's the current status of discussions on that between our country's leaders?
Well, thank you for asking, because I think it's an important part of the conversation, and we need to speak openly about this topic. Obviously, we never thought of this to be one of the main parts of the presidential campaign, so the wall became an important part of the campaign, but it's not anything new. We have had different kind of barriers along the border almost always. And an important part of the frontier has been almost always a kind of barrier. In the case of California, it's almost completely done. In the case, there are a few parts of the border with California where you still don't have a wall, a barrier, whatever name you prefer to use. In the case of Arizona and New Mexico, most of those borders already have a barrier, a wall. The problem, the clear problem, if the determination is to build a wall, the problem is really Texas. And let me try to explain. Then I will speak about the political part. Let me first speak about the legal and geographical issues that are behind this topic. There are four American states that share border with Mexico: California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. There are 24 American counties that share border with Mexico. Two-thirds of those 16 counties oppose strongly to any kind of wall. 8 American counties that have border with Mexico approve that. The problem, again, is Texas. Why? Most of the land in California, Arizona, and Mexico is federal land. It's not the case with Texas, with most of the land is private. You have hundreds, if not thousands, of small owners of land. Most of them have clearly opposed to any kind of wall for whatever reason. Every person is different, but most of them oppose strongly. So very possibly, once the American government offered $2,800 per acre, many of them opposed to that amount of money, and many just don't want to speak about that. They just say, I don't want any wall in my land. So very possibly there will be many, many legal cases opposing this. And sooner or later, I think the federal government will win that part of the story. The thing is that it's long. It takes time to fix these kind of suits. And time flies. But one thing that I have to mention, because it's important, and it has not been part of the discussion. If you remember, the border with Texas and Mexico is the largest, is the longest border, and is roughly 55% of the binational border. There is a river that on the American side is called El Rio Grande, and on the Mexican side is called El Rio Bravo. It's the same river with two different names. It's a long, long river. You want to build a wall, you have to decide in what part of the border you build the wall. You build the wall on the northern side, the river goes to the Mexican side. The other option is to build a wall on the Mexican side, something that Mexico won't ever accept because we don't agree with any kind of wall. So we cannot think of that possibility. So the third option is to build a wall in the middle of the river. So this is a very important topic that we have not really spoken about that, and it's a real important thing. At the end of the day, I think it's not a good idea. It's a very expensive idea. And it could be the determination of the government is to keep building this wall more than a physical wall. Maybe at the end will be a kind of technological barrier. Nowadays, technology has developed a lot. So I don't see how and why to build a physical, big, beautiful wall. Maybe it's more a matter of technology than a physical barrier. And also, because you have to remember, this is important, 65% of the undocumented people living in the US arrive by plane or by car. So you should build a wall 10 kilometers or I don't know how many miles high, something that is obviously impossible to do. So I don't think, and of course, my government doesn't think it's a good idea, it's not convenient, and it doesn't reflect the spirit of the cooperation that we both countries want to have and need to have.
Well, let's turn to that. We can have some more questions on immigration at the Q&A period, but I do want to say that about 2 weeks ago, I was at a meeting where Vice President Pence spoke just after the economic summit with Latin America that was held in Miami. He laid out a very aggressive agenda for cooperation with Mexico. We have a big issue going on right now with NAFTA. I did want to ask one more question before we get into NAFTA, which is Mexico is a petrostate. And so is Alaska. We've been dealing with very low oil prices compared to previous years since really the late 2014. How has Mexico's production fared? How has your investment in the oil industry fared? And what lessons might we learn together on that?
Very interesting, and it's true. Both Alaska and Mexico are oil producers. The situation in Mexico, speaking about oil and gas, both important, related, but different, has changed dramatically. Before NAFTA, Mexico was heavily, heavily depending on oil production and export. It was something like 75 to 80% of the total exports of Mexico before NAFTA were related to oil. Imagine the level, the risk of such a big dependence on one specific product. After NAFTA, the situation, well, you can understand a little bit, in Alaska.
Someone in the audience just said, we know about that. Yeah.
But I don't know if Alaska was so highly depending on just one product. Mexico was 80%.
About 90% of our government's revenues come from that. So.
Well, finally, I found somebody that really understands my feelings. I feel so relieved. Well, now, believe it or not, we depend roughly 5-6% of our exports is oil. So even if we suffer, the problem in Mexico is different. It's the public, the government depends a lot on oil revenues. We are a government oil-oriented country. Lots of the services depend on oil export and taxation. The main taxpayer in Mexico is the oil company, Pemex. I'm sure you have heard about this company. So that's the problem. When the price drops, the government suffers much more than the country. The government suffers. That's why we need, and finally, we made it a change of the constitution, because that was the problem in Mexico. After 1938, a long time ago, when President Lázaro Cárdenas decided to expropriate the oil industry, basically to American and British companies. Since 1938 until this running government of President Peña Nieto, for almost 80 years, not a single private investment was allowed in the oil industry. It was a state monopoly. The situation started to be worse and worse, not having enough money to invest in the oil industry. So finally, at the beginning of this government, 4 years ago, the constitution was changed, and for the first time in modern history of Mexico, private investments, no matter if are Mexicans or foreigners, private investments are fully permitted, fully authorized into the oil and gas industry. So the situation will change, not immediately. You know, oil takes time. It's a complex industry. But we estimate that in something like 5 to 7 years, we will see once again a recovery in the oil industry, because the production was dropping and dropping and dropping. And on top of that, the prices as well. So we were in a quite dramatic position. Now we started accepting foreigners investing in the oil and gas industry. Many companies, few Americans, I have to say, there are more European companies that have accepted the new rules, and mostly Italians and French companies started investing a lot in the oil industry in Mexico and gas. And I think in a few years, in something like 5 to 7 years, we will see a clear recovery. It doesn't mean that we don't understand the importance of the diversification of the sources. We are working hard in order to accept and to incorporate alternative sources of energy, solar energy. Mexico is the country in the whole continent of America with the largest amount of sunshine along the year. We have not taken advantage of that. We need, obviously, to take advantage of gas, not just oil. We are importing a lot from the US, by the way. 60% of the consumption of gas in Mexico is now from the US. We are importing a lot of gas of the US. But also, we need to work on wind and every kind of alternative source is important more and more, because we are really a country committed with the environmental agenda. We are very concerned about the global warming and climate change. This is something that we need to take it into account every day we decide what sources of energy we want to use.
So just one last question on energy, and we'll have time Q&A for that too, but is the Trump administration policy that is predicting North American energy dominance, or it's basically talking about energy dominance, but that really can't happen without Canada and Mexico and the United States working together. Is this a place where our countries are likely, where the agendas are likely to align or not?
I hope yes. If we the three countries work together in this specific sector, energy, we are an unbeatable region.
Say that again.
If we, the three countries of North America, understand that we are the same region speaking about energy, we will be unbeatable. We have more energy, the three countries combined, than any other region of the world. That's why we need to understand that North America is one region. And this is important. Let's speak also a little bit about geography. Many people think that Mexico is not North America. Mexico is North America. Geographically speaking, Mexico is part of North America. So geographically speaking, we are the same geographical region. It's North America. It's not a concession to call Mexico North America. It's actually North America. It's North America. So, and we are so privileged. We are so blessed. Speaking about energy, the three countries have impressive reserves of oil and gas. Impressive reserves, much more than any other region of the world. So we need to understand this and to make this part of the future negotiations of NAFTA. 25 years ago, there was a clear limit. Mexico didn't want to speak about energy 25 years ago because, I always said that, the Constitution at the time didn't allow private investments in energy. Now it's fully free. Mm-hmm. So it's time to sit, the three of us, and to talk clearly, deeply about energy and to make this region the most competitive energetic region of the world.
Well, thank you. So we do have this discussion going on NAFTA, and I'm just remembering back 1994, we had NAFTA come into play. It was a huge argument in the United States. Bill Clinton was president. It was a case where Bill Clinton actually relied on Republican votes to get NAFTA through. There were very few labor unions who supported it. A lot of Midwestern states were quite ambivalent on the issue. The idea was, would we integrate our economies better in North America, allow freer goods trade, and so forth. We had a president who has been elected saying that we haven't made the best trade deals. It's interesting, in your career, you started out working, I think, at the World Bank or in International Economic...
OECD. Paris, yeah.
Yeah, so you were involved in international economic development. And, you know, textbook 101 for a country that's trying to raise its per capita income, as Mexico is, it's $9,000 a year now, is to build exports. And we have a commerce secretary who has said, well, if exports are good for a developing country, why are deficits a good thing for a developed country? So we have a national policy which is trying to levelize trade. And we can get into long economic arguments on whether that makes sense for our country or not. Recently, we had a new deal on sugar trade. Recently, I also saw a senior Mexican official basically saying it was your top negotiator for NAFTA say, we'll talk NAFTA, but don't talk to us about tariffs or quotas. And so we've got the sugar deal out of the way. We have an agreement to discuss it. What do you think is going to happen? And how is this going to affect trade between our countries and the integration of our economies?
Well, it's a very interesting and important question, and is, I think, clearly the most important topic that has to be part of the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. And obviously, we have to remember this is a trilateral free trade agreement. Canada is also a very important player. Let's speak about two different topics, because it's very fair to say, yes, Mexico has an important superavit, trade superavit with the U.S. Actually, two weeks ago, it was the fourth biggest superavit, and now is the second. In 2 weeks, we overtook Germany and Japan. It's roughly $64 billion, the superavit. Big.
What is the word you're using? Soup.
So the in favor this. How okay. Saying superavit, yeah. The positive. This
yeah. Okay.
Is positive. Is not. Yeah. It's the opposite to deficit. I don't know. How do you say in English?
Surplus.
Surplus. Sorry.
Surplus. Thank you.
Sorry. Sorry. So we have a big surplus, $64 billion. What about China? That is $360 billion. Six times bigger than Mexico, with no NAFTA. There is not any free trade agreement between the US and China, and the deficit is six times bigger than with Mexico. So there are more, much more reasons than a free trade agreement when you have a, super, a surplus or a deficit. I think if a country is to blame about to have a superavit, a surplus or deficit, the only country to blame is, or maybe the three countries to blame are innovation, innovation, and innovation. That's the real reason why jobs move. And also, we have been also losers. You see the agriculture sector in Mexico. We lose thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs because of NAFTA. And now we are importing a lot of agriculture products from the US because the US is much more competitive than we are. This is the thing. To try to be as a region more competitive and to understand that we are a region. In some sectors, Canada is more competitive. In some sectors is the US, and in some sectors is Mexico. Let's think all together as an only region and to compete all together, the three countries, against China and other regions of the world. That's the real challenge that we need to find out how to manage properly in the negotiations. Second part of your question, yes. NAFTA was negotiated before internet. There was not internet when we started speaking about this free trade agreement. Imagine how much the world changed in these 23, 24 years with internet. Canada at the time said, guys, I don't want culture, arts, science to be part of NAFTA. So that's an important sector that is not part of NAFTA because the Canadians oppose. Mexico said, we don't want energy to be part of NAFTA. The US said we don't want labor to be part of NAFTA. And there were sectors that didn't exist at the time. That's why they're not part of NAFTA. Telecom, intellectual property, financial services, e-commerce, at the time didn't exist. So put together all these sectors that are out of NAFTA, and it's indeed time to renegotiate NAFTA, to update and to make altogether a much more competitive and sophisticated NAFTA. And I think and I wish that will be the result of this negotiation, for the three of us to update and to have a much more competitive region towards other international regions and competitors of North America. That's the real challenge, and I think we can succeed and to have a much more integrated region. Because don't forget, before NAFTA, we used to sell products to each other. With NAFTA, we produce together. Now we produce together, the three countries. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, this is, I think, is an important data to share. The integration, for every US dollar that the US exports, the component that Mexico exports, 40% is American components.
American content.
Content. Is 4% China and 24% Canadian. So by far, we import and incorporate in our products and in our exports a lot of American content, much bigger than Canada and China.
So to your point, and Council on Foreign Relations did a paper on this where they said that since in the treaty's first two decades, we've gone from $290 billion in regional trade within the three countries to more than $1.1 trillion. But an argument is also made in that paper, and I'm wondering if you agree with this, that it has actually made American cars more competitive with Asian competition, that by integrating our economies, we've actually been more competitive on global markets because of the freedoms set up under NAFTA.
The three countries are exporting much more cars thanks to NAFTA. The three countries. The U.S., as far as I remember, the U.S. is exporting something like 18 or 19 million cars. Mexico is exporting, now we are the seventh producer of cars worldwide, and we became the fourth largest exporter of cars in the world. We overtook France. I don't have the figure for Canada, but also Canada is a producer and exporter of cars. Not that important maybe, but still. The three countries are much more competitive in the car and auto car industry thanks to NAFTA.
All right, so that's the big picture, but then the critics say that we had 350,000 jobs lost in the auto sector in the United States. That's about a third of our auto sector employment. While Mexican oil auto sector employment has gone from 120,000 jobs to 550,000.
Let's speak about agriculture. Mexico has lost basically the same amount.
Mr. Ambassador, let's finish on manufacturing. Is there a way to make this a win-win for the manufacturing industries in both countries?
I think so.
That's the question.
I think so. And for me, one key part of this negotiation will be the rules of origin, the content, to increase the three countries, the amount of regional local content. Now we have been more flexible accepting to import others, auto cars and ingredients to incorporate in the chain. We could increase and to increase, let's say, the limits to outside imports for the auto car and other industries. Let's increase the level of local content for many different industries. That's one of the things we should think to do together.
That would be very interesting to watch. Okay, in terms of the schedule on the NAFTA renegotiation, I want to open up to questions. When do you expect something to come back that your parliament and our parliamentarians will have to deal with?
Well, as you know, we are almost in a month. The 16th of August is the official kickoff of the negotiations. We are 5 weeks away from the kickoff. We wish, and the Mexican government has been very clear indicating that we are ready to negotiate and that we hope to have a fast, smooth negotiation. The problem with Mexico is that we have presidential elections next year, 1st of July. So we are less than a year away from the elections. It's not a good idea. It's not a good idea to have such a complex negotiation in the middle of the presidential campaign. That's why we think we need to speed up and to finish the negotiation late this year.
Thank you.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from Ambassador Carlos Garcia de Alba, the Consul General for Mexico in Los Angeles. This event was hosted by the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Dena'ina Center on July 10th. We return to the program as Lisa Falsko, President and CEO of Alaska World Affairs Council, reads questions from the audience.
Lisa, you got some questions.
We do. We have a lot of questions. We're going to try to get through some of these today. So you talked about several issues that and concerns that are important for Mexico. What is Mexico's biggest concern?
Thinking domestically, you mean? Well, I think the main challenge in Mexico as a country, forget NAFTA and forget the international arena, is national arena, is to fight poverty. I think that that's the main problem we have. And it's not poverty. It's the extreme wealthy and the extreme poor people that we have. We need to close this big gap social gap that we have. That's the main challenge that Mexico and Latin America, if I may say, the whole region of Latin America, that's, I think, the main challenge we have, to close the social gap that we have. Less extremely wealthy people and much more middle class.
Okay, so if NAFTA was to be canceled, how would that hurt or help Alaska?
Well, I don't know. And I hope NAFTA won't be canceled. And let me tell you, it's not a good idea. Because in any case, if there are no free trade agreements, and let's remember, the very first free trade agreement in the world was the one between Australia and New Zealand. Those are the real pioneers of free trade in the mid-80s, if I remember properly. Since then, hundreds, if not thousands, of free trade agreements are everywhere in the world. But if those free trade agreements don't work, bilateral, trilateral, or regional, there is always an international body that regulates free trade agreement. That is the World Trade Organization. That's the referee.
Right.
If NAFTA fails and we don't want any more NAFTA, we have the World Trade Organization rules. Mexico, in that case, if the WTO comes and becomes the referee of trade between Canada, US, and Mexico, the highest, the max tariff that Mexico should pay to export to the US is 2.5%. If the American, in the case of the US, the max tariff, according to the WTO rules, is 7.5%. So it could be more convenient for Mexico than for the US.
Got it.
Okay, and this is actually a follow-up question to that. So this says the president has proposed a 20% import tax, which the House has embraced. So what do you think will be the impact if this tax increase was placed on American consumers?
Interesting. That was the very first question a journalist put to myself after the inauguration of President Trump. And it was from CNN. You can see that interview that I gave to CNN. Because it was the very first proposal that I heard from President Trump. And my answer was very clear. I'm an economist. It's a very bad idea for the consumers. Because who will pay at the end that 20% tax or tariff or barrier, whatever you want to name it, the consumer? So it's not a good idea. It's not a good idea because at the end, the victim is the consumer. And that's why Mexico has insisted not to include in the negotiation of NAFTA new barriers, new tariffs, because at the end, those who will pay the consequences will be the consumers.
Okay, here's going to drugs. Is there any new strategy being developed to deal with a criminal drug culture? And do you have any measure of what drug gang violence is doing to your tourism industry?
Well, it's a big problem, of course. We cannot deny that we are passing through a complicated time. We need to think a lot the best way to fight these criminal rings. We have tried since the inauguration of President Felipe Calderon, the former president. The army has been an important part of this fight against the cartels. But still today, long way to walk. We need to start thinking maybe in a different way without forgetting to have more professional police, not just the army, the police, because that's part of the problem. We don't have a national police. Every single municipality in Mexico has a different police. We need a national police. We are working on that. We are building a national police. We are following the French model, La Gendarmerie Nationale. That is an interesting model. We need also to think about decriminalization of drug consumption, a little bit what is happening in several American states. We need to think about that possibility because to punish the consumption of drugs has proved not to be positive and has that help to fight the problem, and obviously to understand more and more that this is a world problem. It's not just regional, it's not national, it's not just Mexican. And that's why we think we need to work together fighting this problem, the US and Mexico, because it's also a matter of offer and demand.
Right.
And there is a growing demand on the American side of drug consumption. So we wish to have less consumption of drugs in the US. We need much less consumption of drugs in the US, because as far as the consumption in the US keeps growing, there is a big incentive for the cartels to keep producing and to keep selling. So we need to work together, and also on the other side of the coin, the weapons. We need to stop smuggling weapons to Mexico, because there are many, 80% of the weapons that the cartels use to kill people are made in the US. So this is also an important problem that we need to talk and to stop together. It's an international challenge.
Okay, now we're going to move to telecommunications. Is it likely or possible that Carlos Slim's telecommunication monopoly will be broken up?
It's already broken. It's part of the of the reforms that was... we spoke just about energy, but there were 12 major reforms that, for the first time in history, passed the Congress and the Senate of Mexico approved and passed at the very beginning of this government. So we have now an open competition in the telecom industry. Actually, myself, you feel it if you go to Mexico. Few years ago, to use a mobile phone in Mexico was extremely expensive, and the service was not precisely the best. Now, with the new telecom reform, the services in the telecom industry have dropped dramatically, thanks to the telecom reform. So there is not anymore a monopoly.
Okay. There has been a huge rise in obesity and diabetes in Mexico, just like in the United States. What can we do together to curb this serious health issue?
Well, it's true. Mexico has the second rate of obesity in the world and the first among children. It's a very sad story. What we did, and it has proved up to now to be successful, is to tax soft drinks. That is the main source of, sugar. And since we introduced the 10% tax on soft drinks, there has been a substantial, sensitive reduction in the consumption of those drinks, and the rate of obesity is slowly, but is going down, slowing down.
Okay, and the last question is regarding Mexican energy reform. So please highlight for us how the reforms are going, in particular benefiting local people and communities.
Well, we have been able, again, to change the constitution. Now that foreign investment, private investment is allowed, we have mapped the Gulf of Mexico, that is the main source of oil, not gas. Gas is more continental Mexico than the Gulf of Mexico. Up to now, we have four different rounds for international bidders to explore and to exploit oil and gas. All the four rounds have been successful. We have gotten up to now something like $7 billion of new investments in the oil and gas industry. In 3 years is not bad. Many more jobs, of course.
Do you know the production numbers?
We were producing, the peak was 4.5 billion barrels per day. Now the production is almost half of that.
So about 2 million barrels.
Now it's a little bit more, it's 2.2 million. Compared to the 4.5, it's a lot less. But now with these new investments, we expect in 5 to 7 years to recover and to reach once again the record that we had a few years ago of 4.5 million barrels per day.
Those are all the questions, but did you have something else you might want to share with Alaska, any things we might have missed through those questions?
Well, thank you so much. And basically, to invite all of you to consider to do businesses with Mexico, whatever sector activity you have, consider to start exploring business opportunities with Mexico. Or if you are a student, consider to go to Mexico to study or to improve your Spanish or to make a master. Mexico has also very good universities. Would be a good place for many Alaskan students to go. If not 2-3 years at least for a short term, you should consider that. But speaking about businesses, you should explore business opportunities. Mexico is a very open economy. Don't forget that we depend a lot on foreign trade, foreign investment. So it's a very open economy. It's a country that is growing. We have now a 2.8% growth forecast for this year that I know is not big enough, but still, we are an economy that is growing and is increasing the rate of growth. And if I can be of any help, typically, business people think of the know-how. We need to think also of the know-who. It's as important the know-who as the know-how. And typically, the Mexican consulates, and specifically this consul, can help speaking about the know-how. So ready to help.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing from Ambassador Carlos Garcia de Alba, who's the Consul General for Mexico in Los Angeles. This event was hosted by the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Dena'ina Center on July 10th. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.